The crack started as a hairline. I didn't see it at first. I was too focused on the fish. It was 11 o'clock at night, 2 weeks before I was supposed to stock my first batch of tilapia fingerlings, and I'd dragged a shop light out to the backyard to do one final check on the tank before bed. The tank was a black polyethylene stock tank, the kind you see at feed stores, $140, 800-gallon capacity, exactly the right size for what I'd been planning for 3 months. I'd spent those months reading about ammonia cycling, nitrification rates, feed conversion, dissolved oxygen targets. I felt ready, and then I crouched beside that tank in the dark and saw the seam beginning to separate on the low side. The ground beneath it had settled through the first big spring rain. The tank hadn't moved, but the constant pressure of 800 gallons of water, roughly 6,600 pounds, had found the path of least resistance, and that path ran right along the seam where the tank wall met the bottom edge. I stood there with a headlamp in one hand and a roll of waterproof tape in the other, and I understood something for the first time that no article one did read had bothered to tell me. A tank is only as good as the foundation it sits on. Everything else, the plumbing, the filtration, the fish, the feed, the water chemistry, every piece of that system flows downstream from one decision: where you put your tank, what's under it, whether it's level. I lost that tank, drained it before it failed catastrophically, rebuilt the base, started over, and I learned more in that one night than I had in all those months of reading combined. That was 4 years ago. I've built 6 tank systems since then, 2 in the backyard behind my house in central Tennessee, 1 at a neighbor's half acre in Alabama, and 3 more at a demonstration site I help manage with a small homestead cooperative. I've worked with IBC totes, stock tanks, fiberglass aquaculture tanks, repurposed dairy tanks, and one remarkably creative arrangement involving 2 cast iron bathtubs that I will tell you about in another episode, because it actually worked surprisingly well once we sorted the plumbing. And here is what all of that experience has taught me: the single most important skill in backyard protein production is not feeding protocol, not nitrogen cycling, not species selection. It is understanding tank architecture, how to choose the right vessel, how to prepare it, how to position it, how to level it, before you ever add a drop of water. There is something I want you to hold in your mind through this whole episode. A small detail: I almost skipped over the first time I built a system. I had a bubble level, the kind you'd use to hang a shelf, sitting on the workbench in my shed. I'd carried it out without thinking to the cinder block base I'd laid for the first tank, set it on top of the blocks, and watched the bubble drift left, not far, maybe 3/16 of an inch off center. I remember looking at it and thinking, close enough. It wasn't close enough. It never is. That level sat in my shed through 2 failed builds before I understood what it was actually telling me. This episode covers tank architecture from the beginning, sourcing the right vessel, cleaning it properly so it doesn't poison your system before it ever cycles, positioning it for long-term stability, and leveling it with the precision the water itself demands. We are building the foundation before anything else, because if the foundation fails, everything above it fails with it. Let's start with sourcing, because this is where most beginners make their first and most expensive mistake. The vessel you choose determines the volume of your system, the surface area available for gas exchange, the thermal stability of your water, the ease of harvest, and how well your filtration can integrate with your design. These are not small decisions. A tank that works beautifully for tilapia in Georgia is completely wrong for trout in Oregon. A vessel perfect for a 200-gallon prawn setup is dangerously undersized for a 1,000-gallon catfish operation. Before you buy anything, answer 4 questions. First, what species are you raising? High-density protein production in backyard systems most commonly means tilapia, catfish, channel bass, freshwater prawns, or hybrid bluegill. Each has different spatial needs. Tilapia tolerate crowding well. A properly filtered, well-managed system can run 0.5 pound of fish per gallon. Catfish want more horizontal space and are sensitive to depth constraints. Trout demand cold water and aggressive oxygenation. Prawns need substrate and vertical shelter more than raw volume. Know your fish before you size your tank. Second, how much water volume can your site structurally support? 1 gallon of water weighs 8.33 pounds. A 500-gallon system fully loaded pushes past 4,000 pounds. A 1,000-gallon system is over 8,000. Whatever surface your tank rests on must bear that load, permanently, evenly, without settling. Third, what is your climate and your seasonal plan? Black polyethylene absorbs solar heat, which can benefit a tilapia system in spring and fall in northern states and become a serious problem for those same fish on a July afternoon in Mississippi. White or translucent IBC totes allow algae growth in direct sun but stay cooler. Your tank color and material is a climate management decision, not just an aesthetic one. Fourth, what is your budget and your access to used equipment? This has changed dramatically in the last decade because intermediate bulk containers, IBC totes, have become the backbone of small-scale backyard aquaculture. A standard IBC tote holds 275 gallons, can be sourced used in most American markets for $20 to $60, and arrives with a steel cage frame that provides structural integrity and built-in mounting points for plumbing. They are not perfect. The rectangular shape creates corner dead zones if your water circulation is poorly designed, and you must research what the tote previously held before you clean and use it. But for the price, they are the most accessible starting point for a first system. The alternative I personally prefer for systems above 500 gallons is a circular stock tank, polyethylene, typically in black or dark green. The circular geometry creates natural water circulation when the inlet is positioned tangentially, eliminates corner dead zones, distributes pressure more evenly across the vessel wall, and makes harvest significantly simpler. Black polyethylene tanks are easy to source, widely available, and durable under UV exposure. They do require extra thermal management in hot climates. In Tennessee, I insulate the outside of my black tanks with foam board panels during the hottest weeks of summer to prevent temperature spikes that can push tilapia into thermal stress. Fiberglass aquaculture tanks are the professional standard for a reason. They are rigid. They do not leach plastic compounds over time. They hold temperature more consistently, and they last for decades with minimal maintenance. A new 1,500-gallon fiberglass tank from an aquaculture supplier runs between $800 and $2,000. They are expensive, they are heavy, and they require freight shipping. But if you ever encounter a used fiberglass tank from a closing fish hatchery, a restaurant supplier, or a commercial aquaculture operation upgrading their equipment, pursue it seriously. These tanks are engineered for long-term intensive use, and they will outlast everything else in your system. Whatever vessel you source, new or used, polyethylene or fiberglass, you must clean it before it holds water intended for fish. This is not optional. New polyethylene tanks carry mold release compounds from the manufacturing process. Used IBC totes may have held motor oil, agricultural chemicals, corn syrup, industrial solvents, or any number of other substances that will kill fish immediately or slowly and unpredictably. Used fiberglass tanks may carry residual biofilm from previous inhabitants that can harbor pathogens capable of wiping out a new stock within days. The cleaning protocol is straightforward, but must be thorough. Fill the tank completely with clean water and add 1/4 cup of plain unscented household bleach per 100 gallons of capacity. Let it sit for a full 24 hours, drain completely, rinse 3 times with fresh water, then leave the tank to air dry in direct sunlight for at least 48 hours. Ultraviolet light from the sun breaks down residual chlorine compounds more reliably than rinsing alone. If you have any doubt whatsoever about what a used tank previously held, repeat the bleach cycle a second time before proceeding. The cost of a second bleach soak is nothing compared to a tank of dead fish. After cleaning, before positioning, this is where the spirit level matters, and I mean this precisely. Your tank must be level. Not approximately level. Not close enough. Level. Here is the hydraulic reality of why this matters. An 800-gallon stock tank that sits 1 inch out of level carries approximately 50 extra gallons of water pressure on its low side compared to its high side at any given moment. Over weeks and months, that asymmetric load fatigues the tank wall material at the low point, the exact seam location where my first tank cracked. 1 inch, 3/16 of an inch, is enough to cause problems in a large system over a full season. If your tank sits on a concrete pad, use non-shrink grout or plastic shims to level the pad surface before the tank is placed. If your tank sits on compacted gravel, rake and tamp until your level reads true in all 4 directions, side to side and front to back. If your tank sits on cinder blocks, add or remove material under each block individually until every column carries equal weight. Check level again after the tank is filled to capacity, because the weight of the water can cause minor settling that shifts what was level when empty. The base material itself determines the long-term stability of everything above it. Compacted crushed gravel is my preferred base for outdoor tank systems because it drains freely, doesn't compact and settle as dramatically as bare soil, and distributes weight evenly under a large vessel. Use 3/4-inch crushed stone. Compact it in 2-inch lifts using a plate compactor or a hand tamper. Bring it up to a minimum depth of 4 inches beneath the tank base. For systems over 1,000 gallons, I strongly recommend a poured concrete pad with reinforcing wire mesh. The investment in a proper pad pays for itself within the first year in avoided repairs, reduced settling, and the peace of mind that comes from knowing the foundation is true. Position your tank with long-term access in mind. You will be here twice a day for feeding, several times a week for water testing and system observation, and periodically for harvest. Can a net move completely around the tank's circumference? Is there room to step back and look at water clarity from above? Where does the drain outlet lead? And how will you manage that water volume during partial water changes? For a 1,000-gallon system, a 25% water change means 250 gallons of water moving somewhere. That is not a garden hose situation. Plan the drainage before the tank goes in. Tank orientation matters for sun exposure and for plumbing. Orient your inlet to create a consistent circulatory rotation in the water column. The inlet should enter at or just below the surface, angled tangentially against the tank wall, creating a clockwise or counterclockwise flow that pushes solids toward the center and down toward the drain. This circulation keeps dissolved oxygen higher near the surface, prevents the dead zones where waste accumulates, and makes your mechanical filtration work dramatically more efficiently. Your bottom drain, the outlet, should sit at the absolute lowest point of the tank floor, which means your tank must be truly level for the drain to function correctly. A tank that tilts even slightly will have a zone of floor that never fully empties during a drain cycle. Waste settles there, decomposes, consumes dissolved oxygen, spikes ammonia, and destabilizes your water chemistry before you understand what's happening. The biology and the hydraulics are inseparable. The biology follows the physics of the water, and the physics of the water follow the geometry of the tank, and the geometry of the tank follows the precision of the foundation. That level, I want to come back to it one more time. After I drained the cracked tank and rebuilt the base, laid new crushed stone, compacted it properly, shimmed the cinder blocks, I set my bubble level on the new pad and watched the bubble settle. Dead center. Both axes. It took me maybe 2 hours to get that foundation right, and I remember the moment the bubble stopped moving with a feeling that surprised me. Not pride exactly. Something quieter. The sense that something true had been built, and that what came after it would rest on something solid. Every tank I've built since then starts with that level. Every time the bubble reads center before the water goes in, that feeling returns. It never gets routine, because when the foundation is right, everything that follows it has a chance to work. In our next episode, we'll go underground into the plumbing systems that connect your tank to your filtration, and back again. The pump types that work for backyard systems, the PVC schedules that hold pressure, and which ones don't, and the single pipe sizing mistake that turns a healthy cycling system into an oxygen-starved crisis inside of 72 hours. Until then, I want to hear what you're working with. Are you building on a concrete pad, compacted gravel, or bare ground? Are you starting with an IBC tote or a round stock tank? And if you've already got a system running that's giving you trouble, tell me what the bottom of your tank looks like when you peer over the edge. Sometimes the answer is already right there in front of you, if you know what you're looking at.